Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday. It is the 23rd of August. Very nice to have you with us. We have a fantastic panel. We have a lot of good stories. And we welcome you, folks. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to include you in today's program if you have something cool to say. That's all we ask. Let me introduce it. It seems easy, doesn't it? Yeah. Let me get to everybody and do the introductions. We welcome Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey ho.
Hey ho to you. And we welcome Rosemary Armeo, investigative reporter here on this Friday. Good morning. How are you?
Very good.
Excellent. Aaron Pasitti joins us as well. It's been a couple of weeks. We have had so much economic stuff in the news.
Yeah.
And where is our economist? I know you were working and you weren't on vacation or anything, but good Lord, we've needed you, man.
I've been paying attention, so I'm raring to go.
All right. Goodness. We have so
Bring
much.
Bring on the inverted yield curve.
Yeah. Judith was very, very worried and upset about
it. It was on the front page of the Times, and you weren't here.
Hugh Johnson and I talked about the yield curve for about 20 minutes on Vox Pop yesterday.
That was a great show.
We couldn't believe how all of a sudden this is like bond market economics are becoming common discourse.
I think the word is very sexy. Yeah, they've become very sexy.
That's you see, you sound like David. Which is a good thing.
All right. And we also have Judith Enck with us. She is a senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Judith, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. All right. Let's start and go to the news of the day. So, as I mentioned, we've been talking about the economy. So let's talk about the economy. Top White House advisors notified President Trump early this month that some internal forecasts showed that the economy could slow markedly over the next year, stopping short of a recession but complicating his path to reelection in 2020. The private forecast, one of several delivered to Trump and described by three people familiar with the briefing, contrasts sharply with the triumphant rhetoric the president and his surrogates have repeatedly used to describe the economy. Even as his aides warned of a business climate at risk and of faltering, the president has been portraying the economy to the public using words such as phenomenal and incredible. He's told aides that he thinks he can convince Americans that the economy is vibrant and unrattled through a public messaging campaign. But the internal and external warnings that the economy could slip have contributed to a muddled and often contradictory message, which may be one of the better understatements I've ever seen in the Washington Post. But I will let I will throw this to Aaron first for his analysis of what I just read.
So the news just keeps on getting more interesting because literally 10 minutes before we came on air, China just announced that they were going to retaliate with $75 billion in tariffs against U.S. exports that are going to go into effect the exact same dates that Trump's tariffs against China are going to go into effect. The big one, the big tariff that China's planning on imposing is on U.S. autos. So both sides are escalating. There's no sign of China or the U.S. backing down from this. So all this does is create more uncertainty for large-scale investment plans. It's going to create more volatility in stock markets. It's probably going to lead to a sharper inversion of the yield curve. But to a certain extent, Trump is somewhat correct in that if you look at the main macroeconomic indicators of the U.S. economy, the unemployment rate is at 3.7%, the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. But the flip side of that is that the growth rate of job creation has been slowing for the past couple months. Wage growth hasn't been rising as much as it should. You're seeing slowing rates of GDP growth, which is the main measure of economic growth, where you have all of the big financial firms and private forecasters estimating the third quarter GDP growth being lower than it has been in the first two quarters. So there are some indicators that suggest that the U.S. economy is still doing reasonably well. It's just that those signs are becoming weaker. You're seeing a deceleration in growth. And that is largely self-induced in that Trump, by creating this uncertainty about trade, is making business spending much more fragile. It's making investors a lot more skittish. So there's a lot of psychological factors about getting out of the stock market and getting into safer assets like bonds. His chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, Kevin Hassett, resigned in May, and he has not been replaced. So this is a real good time to lack important leadership in key economic
which
positions.
Which is most federal agencies. Or
yeah, right. Yeah, I was going to say this.
The majority.
Just add another one to the list. So his main economic advisor is Larry Kudlow, who's been wrong, I think, 1,000 out of 900 times on things he's spoken of. The interesting thing here is that the policies that the Trump administration has floated about stimulating the economy, were it to slow further or if we were to go into a recession, are probably economists are just probably chuckling in terms of how pathetic they are.
Well, but they're chuckling for two reasons. I mean, one, which you're about to go into, I think, about what they are.
Yeah.
But also the fact that it's difficult to say, oh, everything is great, everything's phenomenal, but here's our backup plan for when everything goes to hell.
Right. Yes, exactly. So I'm going to focus on the former, which is that the capital gains tax, cut that he's proposing, economists almost universally agree that that's going to have no stimulative effect. It's just going to affect people who are selling stocks at the time, which is really the richest 10% of the population, and they tend not to spend as much of their income gains as lower income individuals do. A payroll tax, which is not a bad idea. President Obama did that in the wake of the financial crisis.
Payroll tax cut.
I'm sorry, the payroll tax cut.
Yes.
They're talking about a currency tax to weaken the U.S. dollar, which would make U.S. exports more competitive on world markets. But it's very easy for countries to retaliate and stop that by doing what China did this morning, and that is to increase tariffs. So there's no consensus amongst even Trump's inner circle. Steve Mnuchin has expressed a little bit of wariness about it. Larry Kudlow is just a hack, so he'll just go along with whatever Trump has to say. I think even in Congress, you're going to start seeing a little bit of dissent about whether this is the appropriate policy. He was talking about lowering the corporate tax rate further to 15%. All of these are policies that are not going to do anything to stimulate the economy if it were to go into a recession. These would be policies that are largely handouts to wealthy individuals and people who are invested
in
stock.
So now while you're on the subject, what about the $1 billion, the $1 trillion, deficit?
So there, you know, I have always been of the opinion that deficits really don't matter, provided that federal spending is used in productive ways that can increase the growth rate of the U.S. economy.
Like infrastructure.
Just like now.
Right.
Like, just like we're
sure.
doing now.
Like, so if the government can borrow for 30 years at right around 3%. So as long as we can find an investment project that yields a rate of growth that's beyond 3% over a 30-year period per year, you should spend. And the deficit is just going to be a statistical artifact of that. Politicians use the deficit as a scare tactic. Oh, the government's spending too much. And it's primarily been Republicans who have been talking about government spending being out of control as an excuse to gut social welfare programs. That's the deficit scare. That's not deficit economics. That's
right.
Using the deficits as a political tool.
Well, I think you're starting to see the narrative about the deficit. And if the president is reelected, I think it'll be used to justify cuts in social programs.
And remember what Larry Kudlow and Trump himself and a lot of Trump's economic inner circle said when President Obama was increasing the deficit in the wake of the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression. They said, we should not be spending money. The deficit's too high.
Mm-hmm.
So if the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression doesn't warrant massive federal spending, why does an economy, like Trump says, that is phenomenal and terrific, warrant all of this federal spending?
One other thing, Aaron, if we can ask, because it confuses many of us, me at the top of the list, and that is, could you take just a second to explain the inverted yield curve?
Sure. Yeah, okay. So, so you have to look at – so James Carville, who was an advisor to President Clinton, said if he were
– Seriously, when you went to college, how many times did you think people would say, hey, Aaron, tell me about the inverted yield curve?
I mean zero. And I guess I'm lucky because of that.
Yes, you are.
So James Carville said, if I was ever reincarnated, I'd like to be reincarnated as the bond market, because the bond market doesn't lie. So what an inverted yield curve is, actually, before I get into that, when you're talking about the yield curve, you're talking about the rate of return investors get on government bonds. Government bonds tend to be risk-free investments, so you get very low returns on them. Longer-term bonds, so bonds that mature 30 years from now, tend to have a much higher yield or rate of return than bonds that mature in a year, because there's a lot more that can go wrong in a 30-year period than in the next year or 2 years or however long you consider to be the short term. Bond yields are determined by a lot of factors. The easiest way to explain the inverted yield curve is when investors see risk in the short-term economy. So you can look at bond yields as a reflection of how investors perceive the overall health of the economy. So when you start to see short-term yields, like the yield on the one-year Treasury bill or the two-year Treasury bill, rise above long-term interest rates, it's a sign that investors perceive more risk to economic growth in the short run than they do in the long term. And when you're talking about, you know, trillions of dollars a day flooding into U.S. government bond markets, that's a lot of money, both from U.S. investors and foreign investors. And they're all saying the same thing, is that we see near-term risks to the economy. So Hugh Johnson, who's a local financial advisor, was saying that he's predicting a recession in the summer of 2020. And I don't think he's far off. Now, you can, you know, so maybe it's winter 2020 or
October 2020.
Whatever it is that there's a serious short-term risk. The inversion of the yield curve, when short-term yields rise above long-term yields, has been almost a 100% accurate predictor of every recession that has happened since World War II. That doesn't mean that when the yield curve gets inverted, a recession happens the next day. It means that a recession is likely to happen somewhere in the near term, a year, 2 years. And the consensus is that it will likely happen during the tail end of President Trump's presidency. So, I really hate saying this, but for people who are looking for ammunition, the Democratic candidates specifically about increasing their chances of beating Trump, a recession would be really good, because politicians that have experienced recessions in the last 2 years of their terms, I believe, have never been reelected.
Is there a way to reverse an inverse curve like this?
Sure.
When we're in this state, what measures would really be required? Would real economists
take? So any policy that would rapidly increase economic growth in the short term. So,
like an infrastructure project,
or using federal money to combat climate change and use that to subsidize, you know, very rapidly growing industries in clean energy. The Federal Reserve could lower rates further, which, again, like I've said, I think they overshot in the past.
Yeah.
And now that they see, you know, with the China trade war escalating, the risk of Brexit, that these things are actually real and going to be happening later this fall and this winter. So the Fed now sees a lot of near-term risks, and they're looking at cutting rates.
None of those are politically acceptable to Trump, except lowering the interest rate.
But the Federal Reserve is independent, and Trump
Correct.
Can blabber all he wants
Which
about what the Fed
of,
should
right?
be doing. It just so happens that I think the Fed was wrong to raise interest rates as rapidly as they did. So in this case, I think Trump's right. The Fed should be lowering interest rates. But he's got very different motives. He's not saying lower interest rates to better the state of the economy, to increase wages, to increase business hiring. He's thinking lower interest rates to preserve the economy and to reverse the damage that I've already done so that I get reelected. So for anybody who really wants to get wonkish on this, Jerome Powell is going to
be... We haven't been wonkish for the last 20 minutes, but go ahead.
No, that's... If you want to hear wonkish...
No, this is great. This is great.
So every year, the Federal Reserve and international central bankers, the politically independent economic policymakers of all of the world's major economies, get together in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, for their annual conference. And there you start to see these policymakers be a little more loose-lipped and a little more speculative about what's going to happen in the future, as opposed to their normal bland statements or press releases. And a lot of very interesting ideas get floated at that you see implemented in the future. So Jerome Powell talks today, this afternoon, I believe. So anybody that's interested to see what the Federal Reserve is thinking, and I can tell you that they're a much saner group of people who in their thinking about economic thought than Trump's team. That's where you're going to see the real forecast about where they think the global economy is headed.
All right. It was a great soliloquy.
Thank you.
Wow, you can go take a shower now. we're going to come back. Two quick breaking news stories. One, David Koch has passed away of the Koch brothers. Also, Seth Moulton has dropped out of the presidential race. So there's
Seth who?
We'll be back.
Remind me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judith Ank, Aaron Pasitti, and Rosemary Armeo. We do have letters. Let's go to a few of those. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Kevin writes and says, is asking about tariffs and inflation. How come the tariffs haven't raised inflation by much?
So the effect of tariffs are not going to really show up in a material way in substantially lower growth or changes in inflation directly. What you're going to see is that businesses get skittish because of the uncertainty and the hit they're going to take on their earnings by having higher input prices, or firms like Home Depot who have already projected a $2 billion decrease in their earnings. What you're going to see is that you're going to have businesses stop hiring workers because of the uncertainty. And then if you start to see growth slowing, that those lack of hirings might lead to a reduction in hours. And after the reduction in hours comes the layoffs. And with the layoffs comes the decline in consumption. And the decline in consumption is what produces recessions.
God.
The hip
so
bone
depressing.
Is connected to the
yeah,
leg bone.
Yeah.
All right.
Could I just say one thing? And that is that I've been puzzled by Chuck Schumer, who has been agreeing, Aaron, with the president on China. You know, China's bad behavior and all the rest of it. They're at a time when a lot of people think Chuck Schumer should be the leader in chief, yelling about Trump. Could you talk to us about that a bit?
I mean, there's very few economists will disagree that China has played unfairly given rules that have been set by liberalized Western economic democracies. China has a very heavy state subsidy policy in terms of targeting certain industries. They have intentionally undervalued their currency, which makes their exports more attractive to nations like the U.S. They've engaged in technology transfer where they are able to use intellectual property from U.S. firms for their own benefit. So there's no doubt that China has been playing unfairly, but that's technically allowed. There's no law that says a country can't devalue its currency to gain a competitive advantage. The U.S. could have been doing that. The U.S. was strengthening its dollar the whole time China was weakening its currency.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I see where Schumer's coming from in taking, a hard line against China. The issue is not that China has been playing unfairly. It's that to the extent that the world wants to change how China operates within the world economy, there's a better approach than having Donald Trump go at it alone. There could be a multinational contingent of countries that can leverage a lot more pressure on China than just the U.S. can. And you haven't seen that because economic policymakers probably don't want to get involved with Trump.
We got this letter from Elizabeth who says, good morning, panel. When the economy is said to be up, where is the money? Who has it? Did it flow to the biggest holders of stock and the upmost 1%?
Yep.
All the new jobs include temporary and part-time while wages are keeping up with the cost of living. Don't we want Americans and all others to thrive, not merely survive? So many people are terribly worried.
That is absolutely correct. Excellent point, Elizabeth. So You know, estimates show that, you know, since the end of the last recession, that about 90% of all of the wealth gains created have gone to the top 1% of income earners. It's important to remember that when people talk about stock prices going down, the richest 1% of the population owns 50% of all stocks. The richest 10% of the population, where you're looking at people who are earning, you know, mid to high six figures, own 90% of the stock. And the remaining, so the bottom 50% of the populations own no stock. The issue is that people kind of look at the stock market as one indicator of how the economy is doing and adjust their behavior and sentiment accordingly. So yeah, the gains in growth have been remarkably unequal. The jobs that have been created tend to be lower wage, lower quality jobs. So despite the low unemployment rate, it says nothing about the quality of unemployment and the number of hours workers are able to work.
Keith says, I'm a big fan of Dr. Pacitti.
Thanks, Keith.
But.
I love you.
But.
Not so fast.
Wait.
I'd have to disagree with this claim that any investment by the government that yields more than 3% returns is worthwhile. These are environmental costs to those projects and goods that the government borrows money to finance.
That's a very important caveat. Yeah, so we could invest in, we could subsidize hydrofracking, and that would increase growth and increase the number of jobs, but do extreme environmental damage. So, Keith, that's an excellent point.
And the federal government
does. I know. Yeah. So it's... That was something I glossed over. I'm happy you brought it up. Not all growth is created equal.
Charlie says the American people have to get involved in this trade war with China in order for it to benefit us in the long run when the Chinese decide to not buy our products that people don't buy American. When the U.S. government decides to tariff Chinese goods that American people ultimately pay those tariffs because we don't stop buying Chinese products. Buy local, buy American. Or we will lose this trade war.
So Trump thinks he has the advantage, right? Because of the unequalness of these tariff changes. So is he right about that, Aaron?
He's partially right. I like the buy local, but buying American has kind of lost its meaning because a lot of products that are labeled as made in the USA use a substantial amount of foreign imports. So if you look at, you know, buying a Ford, most of the parts Ford uses are manufactured outside of the U.S. Those cars are assembled in Mexico. So buying American is kind of meaningless in a global economy. The answer is that it's real tough to get – I mean, companies have these really long-term integrated supply chain and logistics contracts that are very difficult to get out of given the amount of capital investment. So companies just can't start making products elsewhere, bring manufacturing back to the U.S. without a substantial disturbance to the economy. So consumers are relatively powerless here to the extent they want to shop local. But there's a lot of products that local firms don't make that you can really only get at Home Depot and Lowe's. And a lot of those products do come from China or have foreign inputs.
It's an interesting point because, you know, a number of years ago, prompted by my colleague David Gillette, who used to work here, I put a tiny little bit of money into Ford. And I check it. It's Ford stock. And I check it every once in a while. And the other day it was up.
Well, I guarantee it's going to be down today.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I get
exactly.
out.
Too late.
Who's playing the trade war better, China or the United States?
Nobody can play a trade war effectively.
Yeah.
It's a matter of who loses less.
It's a gamble.
It's a gamble. And, when you go into a war, the other side's not just going to roll over. And I think given China's willingness to use heavy-handed state policy and intervention in foreign currency markets to make Chinese exports more attractive.
That's an advantage.
That's an advantage. And the U.S. could easily change their policy to match that. But that's certainly not the part of the economic philosophy of the current administration.
But part of this is political and political science
sure.
stuff, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, President Xi, he's dictator for life now. He's just changed that. Trump has to go to an election in 2020. So there's a big difference. Everybody said, well, if the market tanks, Trump is toast. Xi says, I don't care. Am I wrong about that?
No. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, if a recession does happen, Trump will say, listen, I've been tough on China. That was my promise. There's going to be some short-term costs. We're going to help the people that have suffered, like farmers and car manufacturers. But in the long term, we're going to win. Trade wars aren't about winning. Economists since, you know, David Ricardo in the late 18th century have been saying that trade can be a win-win proposition for all countries. It just has to be done under some mutually agreed upon rules that have the opportunity to benefit both nations.
I think the dilemma for Trump, and she knows this, is there are so many voters who say, I don't like Trump's racism. Mm. I don't like his sexism. The list could take me an hour. I don't like Trump blank.
Trump's paintings.
But the economy is doing well. And if that narrative is no longer the case. I mean, that's why the president is saying everything's great, it's rosy, but, you know, people will notice.
Sure.
Then I think there's enormous political peril for the president, and she just plays the president. She just plays the waiting game.
And like right. Like Alan has pointed out, and I've pointed out, you know, a million times at this point, Trump's not going to lose the third of the electorate that constitute his base. But if a recession does happen, those swing voters will say, all right, we gave the guy a chance. I liked what he was saying, but it clearly hasn't worked for me. So I might reconsider my vote.
And last letter before we go to a break is from Christopher, who says this about the payroll tax cut. Asked the question, won't that affect the solvency of Social Security? Maybe a quick fix now, but detrimental down the road.
Well, so Americans pay 6.2% of their paychecks in the form of a payroll tax, which supports Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. If it's a short-term cut like President Obama's was, it might have a very small effect. But when you look at the assets the Social Security Administration holds, you're talking about trillions of dollars. So this would largely just be a drop in the bucket.
But would the House Democrats go along with this?
Oh, that's a tough question.
Because the president can't do this unilaterally.
No. Right now, given the state of the country's infrastructure, given the amount of money that would need to be spent on infrastructure, given the rate of return on infrastructure projects, that's the stimulus package that should be needed. And I can believe that Trump is not trying to do something that would have broad bipartisan support.
Infrastructure week. Still not
still
happening.
Waiting,
and that was
yeah.
one of his campaign promises, was infrastructure.
Waiting.
It was the first big economic initiative during the Obama administration, and it really pumped the economy and did a lot of good. A lot of water treatment plants were upgraded. A lot of highways were maintained, although I would have preferred that all go into mass transit. But it's kind of a no-brainer. And there's bipartisan support, but I think it just shows the lack of effectiveness of the Trump administration right. in getting Congress to do anything.
I keep trying to think of what he thought would happen. Did he really believe in his art of the deal so much that the Chinese would say, oh, we really like you, let's solve this? Is that what he was after?
Probably. I mean, China's not a business. It's the world's second largest economy.
Exactly.
You know, it's not like you're just negotiating with a competing real estate developer for a piece of land. The stakes are a lot higher, and Trump is not particularly politically savvy.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of other stories to discuss, and we will do that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Ink, Rosemary Armeo, and Aaron Pacitti. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Like an annual holiday gathering where the main goal is to get through the day without a family explosion, one of France's main objectives as host of this weekend's Group of Seven Summit is to minimize the chances that President Trump will blow it up. This from the Washington Post. Subjects on which to tread lightly include some of the biggest problems the world's major economies are facing: trade, the system of international rules that has ordered the democratic world for decades, and climate change. That according to both U.S. and other G7 officials. Already, Trump has shaken up the schedule, calling at the last minute for a special meeting Sunday morning to discuss the global economy. Senior administration officials said he will contrast U.S. growth with Europe's economic doldrums and press his pro-jobs and fair trade messages. There obviously is a lot else to discuss in at the G7, and France is just looking to see what they can do to hoping to largely sidestep and have what they call substantive negotiations instead.
Joe, you left one thing out,
yes,
which is fascinating. Many of us have thought that Trump is beholden to the Russians. And obviously, Trump is very intent on bringing the Russians back into the 7 and making it 8. So, you know, that is, I think, one of the dark pieces of dark music behind all of this.
And they've said that they're anticipating no agreements to come out of this G7 agreement, including allowing Russia to re-enter. Making the G7 the G8 again. And I think this would be the first time when there was no agreement at a G7 meeting. And I think there's going to be a huge amount of discussion about climate change, particularly
with
the fact that the Amazon is burning. And that may not have been on the agenda a month ago, but these countries are going to need to talk about it and not just wring their hands, but talk about economic policies to address this.
And it might be a two-ring circus this time. Boris Johnson will be there from UK, and that appears to be the only part of this session that Trump has any enthusiasm for. Didn't he want to go to the G7 meeting?
So let me go back to the Russians for one second, if I may, and that is that clearly Trump knows, and his polling is showing, I'm sure of this, that the American people are deeply suspicious of his relationship with the Russians, which may get to your very perceptive point, which is that maybe this isn't the right time to do it.
Well, and he tried to do it last time, right? I mean, he tried to do it at the Canadian summit, and that went over not well.
And last week he called Macron and claimed that Macron was open to this idea, which I don't think was true. And then remember, President Trump then attacked President Obama for overstating the problem in Crimea. It's just like you just circle the drain.
He got Alan, you have a theory that he's beholden to Russia.
I think Putin is pulling the strings.
This behavior is really consistent with that.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the case. I think we've seen it from the beginning, and I think they know it's extremely dangerous. They got two things to worry about here: the economy, certainly, that could really kick them in the behind. Then the second thing, of course, is the Russians. We have seen, you know, the firing of an FBI director, talking to the Russian delegation, and saying, "I got rid of this Russian thing." I mean, it's almost too much.
Yeah, I think the other thing that Trump fails to understand is that his unilateral trade war with China affects other countries too. So just because, you know, tariffs are imposed against Chinese exports, that raises the cost of German manufacturing, and the German economy has just shown for the first time negative growth. It affects Japan, which has shown the same thing. Trade wars have a way of diffusing themselves throughout the world economy, even if other countries are not direct players. So I can't imagine Germany and Japan are happy about this. And that says nothing about trying to structure some type of reasonable Brexit.
And while we're on the subject, I'm sorry, Joe, this may take us down a bad road, in which case I apologize and pull back. And that's the relationship between Japan and South Korea, which seems to be blowing up right now. Hello, everybody.
Anybody?
Hello.
I don't know. Okay. I'm thinking of starting a pool to see in how many ways or the first time that Trump will embarrass us, embarrass America at this meeting.
Well, he hasn't even got there, and he has. He's on the tarmac. I mean, you know, he's there to promote Russian interests, as Alan mentioned. He's not going to want to talk about the Amazon being on fire, which I think will be front of mind for most of the people at the G7, maybe not Boris Johnson. But, you know, this is a really urgent situation. And so this meeting with the exception of Trump and Johnson being there, is well-timed. And I think even if they don't reach consensus, the five other countries will leave there with some kind of plan of action, because this is urgent. There are
Okay, so you're our expert. So my question to you on this, my question to you is, you got a president of that country who is saying, no, no, you guys all despoiled your environments. We wanted to spoil, basically, this is what he's saying. We wanted to spoil ours, and you have no right to tell us what to do, and we haven't got any money to do it anyway. What do you make of that?
Well, the United States is despoiling its environment, particularly during the Trump administration with expanded oil and gas drilling on public lands. But it's nothing compared to this. I mean, there's an 83% increase in fires.
Right, right, right. And so how do you make them behave?
I think economically. I think with economic policy, because he, you know,
sanctions.
Bolsonaro, how do I say his name? Dare I say, worse than Trump, or similar, very, very similar to Trump.
And I think selfish. It's called selfish.
I think the only way you get him to move is with some really strong economic policies, that we're not going to buy his products. And, you know, he's already said that they have no ability to put out the fires. And he is rooting for
no desire or no desire to put out.
Well, it started with no desire, and now they're up to about 73,000 fires have been detected. So he fired the head of the research agency that pointed out the problem. And, you know, where have we seen that before? And now he's saying, even if we wanted to, we don't have the ability to put these fires out. And, you know, he wants more mining in the rainforest. He wants more farming. He's on board with deforestation. But I think privately he is probably saying this is out of control.
There's also the possibility that European leaders trying to talk reason or to discuss with Trump would have the opposite effect. That's what we've seen at these other summits, and that he'll double down into his own America first. I don't care what's happening in the German economy or the Japanese. It's terrifying.
Yeah, the best thing would be for President Trump to just kind of wander off and do some sightseeing and not really be at the table when these serious conversations are happening.
Which he has done.
Not likely to.
But he has left early and changed his schedule and gotten ticked off and just left, right?
And he's very uncomfortable with the smaller setting of the G7.
Maybe he should go play golf in Greenland.
I don't think he has any clubs there. He only apparently does it at his own clubs, which we're paying for. I have to stop this. We had a very interesting note from a listener yesterday talking about how we are just spewing hate. Why can't we see the other side of Trump? So I've really been trying in this conversation to think, okay, what are his real ulterior motives? What is he thinking? How could this work out? I can't do it.
I hate
his policies.
He has hijacked the government to enrich a handful of very special interests and appeal to the ideological leanings of his base.
Yeah.
And his own
benefit.
And his own special interest. I mean, I think there could be a very simple explanation about his affinity with Putin, and that is he really, really wants to build Trump Tower in Moscow. I mean, I think all of his decisions are through the prism of what is better for his financial interest, particularly if he leaves office in a year and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. I think Karl Marx said the state is the executive arm of the bourgeoisie. So
this
here we are.
Washington Post article quotes a senior administration official as saying Trump wants to brag about the U.S. economy and is uninterested in the many other issues that concern the G7. So,
of course,
that's sort of what you walk into. Let's take a break. When we continue, we will be back. We have many other stories. Alan Chartok is here, Judah Thank, Aaron Pasitti, and Rosemary Armeo. We will continue our conversation. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Third and final act of the roundtable panel for this Friday morning at 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Judith Ank, Aaron Pasitti, and Rosemary Armeo are all here. I have a handful of letters. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on to other equally upsetting topics. Okay. Betsy says, my penny's worth, formerly my 2 cents. I believe Trump will wait until 3 weeks before the election and reverse all the tariffs.
That was very clever.
Very cute, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry. I believe, although Betsy is good at that, I believe Trump will wait until 3 weeks before the election and reverse all the tariffs. Market will spike, and he'll be in the White House for another 4 years.
Nah, the damage will be done by then.
Think so?
Yeah.
All right. Elliot.
And then he appears as weak on China, which is he built his whole administration around being strong and being a bully with China. So.
No, but I think she has a point in saying that nothing is beneath him in terms of short-term gain, political gain like that. And he'll get something for it. It may not be what he needs, but he'll get something for it.
We go to Elliot, who says, I manage utility energy efficiency programs, specifically LED upgrades for small businesses, and the tariffs have significantly impacted the costs of LED lighting. That has in turn affected the number of projects small businesses undertake. This will have an impact on New York State's ability to meet its energy efficiency renewable energy goals. This is not theoretical. It is happening now.
Sorry. That's absolutely correct. And also solar panels are impacted, which I don't think concerns President Trump because he's such a promoter of the fossil fuel industry. But this is, you know, these are the sort of economic impacts, though, that I think day-to-day people don't recognize. You know, what Elliot described is absolutely true, and we're going to pump more carbon into the environment, and local governments will spend more on electricity. But I think until people see, you know, back to school prices being up.
Home remodeling costs.
Can't get mortgages at the rates they'd hope. Until they, or, you know, you have to work 3 jobs rather than 2 jobs. I think until they see that, it's not going to really penetrate the consciousness of most Americans.
Yeah, right now it's a very nebulous concept. The Wall Street Journal, and if you ignore their opinion pages, their reporting on the trade war has been absolutely phenomenal. And they do these fascinating interviews with, you know, small and medium and large business owners about how the tariffs are likely to affect them. And it's this really good micro reporting on how the tariffs are already affecting, or the proposed tariffs are already affecting the decisions of businesses today. So I really recommend people check out the Wall Street Journal to see the, you know, the micro impacts of that.
Did you notice that Tim Cook, the head of Apple, went to the golf club in New Jersey, Bedminster, last week to have dinner with Donald Trump, and that was because of the impact on Apple products. Right. Now that could send people into a tailspin if their iPhone doubles in price. But Elliot's the letter writer point is excellent.
Douglas writes to us and says, very nice overview of the bond market, but I disagree with Aaron's conclusion that the Fed moved the Fed rate up too quickly. I think it looks that way in hindsight only because of Trump's reckless policies around the globe and at home, including his ill-advised application of tariffs. Almost all of his actions have created uncertainty, which is an anathema to financial markets.
I think you're 50% right. So the Federal Reserve has an inflation target of 2%. Which means, you know, they're trying to promote economic growth that's around 3% and maintain low unemployment. The Fed got the unemployment part right, but they have not been able to hit their growth target or their inflation target. So raising rates when inflation and growth are lower than you expect them to be is kind of a sign that interest rates went up too fast.
Wendy says, I'm not an economist or a soothsayer, so I'm wondering how we can continue to run economies based on voracious, seemingly insatiable global consumerism as the planet burns and melts. Yeah. This approach seems patently unsustainable. Are there any possibilities for refitting the global economy while repairing the planet and reversing climate change and also avoiding a devastating worldwide depression?
Thank you, Wendy. That, in my view, that's actually the foundational issue here. You know, Americans are 7 or 8% of the world's population, and we consume about 30% of the world's natural resources, create about 35% of the world's waste. This is unsustainable. And so as I hear the debate on, you know, buying American and buying local, I think we also need to inject into that buying less. And maybe that is not good for some factories in China or Asia, but environmentally, you know, you can lead a really happy, productive life without buying so much plastic crap from China. Dare I say that?
It just worries me that it's even more basic than that, Judith, that there is no... The economy of every country is based on a continually increasing yes. population, which causes all the other problems and exacerbates them. But yet, if you let that drop, and especially in the United States where the birth rate is dropping and we don't want migrants anymore or refugees, how do you sustain your economy, much less improve your environment? Has anyone figured it out?
No. In a word, no. And a lot of this growth doesn't consider environmental externalities. And
right.
that's really where the debate needs to be.
So here is a follow-up on that thought from our friend Sue, who says, please ask the panel to comment on the impacts of fires, floods, earthquakes on the economy. How do we build in resiliency for what will continue to increase in frequency?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a classic example of externalities. You can pump lots of carbon into the atmosphere, and then you get Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Sandy, and that devastates the economy. I mean, we should be building in resiliency, but we're often doing just the opposite. We're still having real estate projects right on the water's edge. We are not investing in renewables and energy efficiency at the rate that we need to even meet the Paris Climate Accord goals. But there's this fundamental disconnect. The Obama administration proposed a regulation, the Clean Power Plan, to regulate carbon from fossil fuel plants, which the Trump administration withdrew. People are surprised. We don't regulate carbon emissions from fossil fuel plants. So how are we going to deal with all of these climate impacts if you don't do the most basic things?
You know, Judith, you're amazing in terms of telling us what's going on in this world. We know that. And you're to be commended for it. Now tell us how we can put a stop to, how we can make the change. In other words, you keep
Fix
saying
it,
should
Judith.
we should. But I think I get a lot of letters from people who say, yeah, we know it's bad, but what do we do?
Well, it's very hard to change things just with individual behavior choices. We need to elect candidates who are committed to environmental protection. We need to change the laws. We need to convince businesses that the environment matters in their decision-making process. How many times do we hear, our fiduciary responsibility, we can't consider things like producing more single-use plastic packaging. I was at the Troy City Council last night where they wonderfully passed a plastic reduction law. But the representative from the polystyrene industry shows up filled with misinformation and basically saying polystyrene is cheap, so we've got to stick with that. Polystyrene is cheap, but at what cost? So I think, there are certainly individual actions, but I often think of Cesar Chavez's quote, which we hear more lately, the only time we lose is when we quit. And we just can't quit. And we've got to elect Republicans, Democrats, Tea Party, Green Party, Green Tea Party. We got to elect
people. Is Bernie
people.
The guy? Does he have the plan?
Bernie's plan on climate yesterday is excellent.
And there's economic benefits to that as well.
Yes.
It's not just environmental. It's a way to kind of merge smart economic growth with environmental sustainability.
And our indigenous energy resources in New York, for instance, are not coal and oil and gas. It's the sun. It's
wind.
It's hydropower. It's geothermal. I mean, the whole goal of the Green New Deal, it's not aspirational. It is good for the economy and will prevent a climate crisis. So, you know, it's interesting with Inslee getting out of the race, people are saying, so who's the climate candidate? Well, the majority of the Democratic candidates have very good climate agendas. Mm-hmm. Not all of them.
So Bernie Sanders came out yesterday with his Green New Deal, a $16 trillion climate plan. What are the highlights, and what is this? What blanks does this fill in from the earlier Green New Deal that was announced?
So the Green New Deal that Senator Markey of Massachusetts and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are promoting is essentially a resolution that then says do a plan in all of these areas. What Bernie Sanders proposed is getting to 100% renewable energy by 2030 in both the electricity sector and the transportation sector. We cannot forget transportation. And to achieve complete decarbonization by 2050. Not only is this doable, but it's urgent that we do it if we're going to avert the economic impacts of catastrophic climate change. What was interesting is Sanders' plan does not endorse nuclear power. It does not endorse garbage burning. It does not endorse carbon capture and sequestration, right, which is kind of shaky. But oddly, he does not advocate for a carbon tax, but the way he wants to pay for this is by eliminating subsidies for fossil fuels, which seems pretty sensible to me. You and I as taxpayers are subsidizing the oil, gas, and coal industry. And he also wants to make major cuts in the military budget. He has
a good idea also.
So
he has a plan to get to that price tag.
But what will it do? How will it go against the other candidates? The big thing, of course, is the price tag, $16 trillion. Biden has called for spending $1.7 trillion over 10 years. Elizabeth Warren has said $2 trillion in green manufacturing plan. Other candidates have put forth proposals, but nothing coming close to $16 trillion.
Yeah, and this is the equivalent of what we need to avoid catastrophic climate change, and it will create a lot of jobs.
So the question is, will we see a uptick in Bernie's numbers? I suspect not.
That's interesting, Alan. I have never been a fan, ever. This is the first time I've really paid attention to Bernie. I think he's got something here.
Okay.
So maybe I'm unusual.
I think you're typical. 93% of Democratic voters support a Green New Deal. And for Democratic primary voters, particularly younger voters, climate change is a major driver in how they vote.
But this is not a pro-Biden comment that I'm making. Biden leads. He keeps going up. Bernie doesn't do well. Bernie now comes out with a $16 trillion whatever, a plan. Biden remains relatively quiescent. Rosemary quite correctly says this makes me pay attention to Bernie. The question is, are we going to see a shift in the polls?
Right.
Or are people going to continue to keep their heads in the sand? Is Biden's quiescence going to be rewarded?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, the way you phrase it, Alan. And Bernie is making a pitch, as he always does, towards the millennials. But this is the issue. And increasingly, older people are coming around to see it that way. So I'm going to be looking at the polls on this.
Yeah, if you end fossil fuel subsidies, which are about $700 billion in the U.S., and raise taxes on fossil fuel producers.
And cut military spending, which is way overdone anyway.
Yes. Even if you ignore the military spending, the math that I just did in my head is that pays for about 10% of the program. A lot of the program could be paid for with the growth that it generates in terms of creating new jobs and the tax revenue. The money's there. It's not like the United States is a poor country. It's that the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a very rich elite and a lot of major corporations that have incredible lobbying power. So the money's there. It's just that it's being held by special interests and people who don't want to give it up for the common good.
Right.
So the possibility here is that we're talking about the end of the world as we know it, right?
Yes.
Judith?
Yes.
That's the way it is. And we see the oceans going up and warming and doing all of that. And then we see people saying, don't bother me. That's the problem. I want to have what I have, and I don't care. And I don't really believe it's some amorphous thing that it's going to happen, but it is going to happen. So how close to its happening do we have to get before we make corrections?
Well, I think people in Florida realize it's happening now because of all the hurricanes and the weather. You know, the drought in the Midwest, the fires out west.
Maybe, but the Republicans keep winning in Florida.
True. But I think younger voters are voting on climate change and gun control issues in Florida in a way they haven't before. You know, the planet's going to survive. It's just the people who are left here are going to really be struggling with heat waves and sea level rise and food scarcity and, you know, the migration that's currently happening because of climate change. But I think this is emerging as a central issue, at least on the Democratic side. And Joe Biden is going to have to catch up with his climate proposals because they're kind of warmed over proposals from 5 years ago.
And no, so, you're right, but only if people believe it. In other words, this is all about an election. This is all about whether people are going to give him a vote or not. Right now, we see him in the lead, and we see his lead, frankly, increasing. But, you say Joe Biden's going to have to do it, but, you know, but why?
But also, and let me just interject this, but to your point, Alan, I mean, even $1.7 trillion from Joe Biden is still a hell of a lot more than whatever Donald Trump is proposing.
Oh, yes. Sure. I mean, Trump is going in the total opposite direction. Every single Democratic candidate, even Seth Moulton, who I actually know who he is. I was joking before when I said Seth who. Every single Democratic candidate is substantially better on climate change policy than Donald Trump, who is opening up federal lands for oil and gas drilling, who's subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, who is not only just pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, but to your earlier point, Alan, about, you know, Brazil saying, why do we need to not burn down the rainforest? Bolsonaro said, you know, the United States pulled out of the Paris Accord. Maybe it's not so good, although Brazil is still in it. Mm-hmm. So this is changing almost weekly. And I think candidates who are not watching the energy around the climate change issue, you know, miss that at their peril. I think this is going to be a top three issue along with healthcare and the environment, certainly for Democratic voters. And we're starting to see polling that it is breaking through among Republican voters, especially younger Republicans and, interestingly, evangelical Republican voters.
What are the top three? Environment, health, and what's
and
the
economy.
But we got a letter. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we got a letter that said, why aren't you people talking about the real important thing, the nuclear threat? Well, you know, I've been talking about this for a while. The nuclear threat, of course, is always very important. But compared to the degradation of the planet, the end of civilizations as we know it, the nuclear doesn't take a primary spot.
I'm not so sure that's true after today's news that the Russians are now orbiting a nuclear reactor around
floating.
The planet. Yeah, floating. And they say at the same time that they're hiding information about a missile experiment that went awry on land that, there's absolutely no danger. I have such trouble believing that.
Well, you were just listing the top issues, Rosemary. Why wasn't nuclear in it?
Well, I see that as part of environment.
And Alan. Clean drinking water. And toxic exposures. It's all in the bucket.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We have we just have a minute or two here. I would like to quickly talk about what's going on in Newark and make a connection to, obviously, the last time we've heard stories like this is from Flint, Michigan, and what is going on in Newark. And because they're handing out bottled water, but of course, people are wondering, you know, maybe they could do something else.
Yeah, this is really troubling. I've been watching this closely. And this is a problem in many major cities, lead in pipes. So the problem is it's called lead service lines. It's the pipes that run to the buildings.
May I interject that, well, as EPA regional administrator, New Jersey was your...
Yes.
Newark was in your area.
Yes. Is this her fault?
No.
No.
Absolutely not. But... certainly, we've known that Newark has had problems with lead service lines for a long time, and there simply is not the money in Newark to remove the lead service lines. So the first thing you have to do is be honest with the public. And if they're drinking lead-contaminated water, you got to get them to stop drinking lead-contaminated water. And then you have to find massive amounts of state or federal dollars
to make
through
change.
A water infrastructure initiative, for instance, to replace the lead service lines. But, you know, lead is a potent neurotoxin. It's a real risk for kids, for pregnant women.
It's awful.
Old people. This is Flint all over again.
Why is the governor not declaring it a public emergency? That was not answered.
Right.
He made an appearance on television on MSNBC yesterday.
That
was not asked. Why is this not a public emergency?
We just have 30 seconds.
Because he doesn't want this to look like his Flint. And I generally think Governor Murphy has pretty good environmental policies, but he is blowing it on this
big time.
One.
Yeah.
All right. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. I hope you all have a beautiful, safe weekend. Thank you very much for joining us. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pacitti, and Rosemary Armeo. Thank you all.
Thank
we
you.
Thank you for your letters. And we will return to the roundtable after this short break.